from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. On Monday, Zambian writer Namwale Serpell won the 2015 Kane Prize for African Writing for her short story, The Sack. The Kane Prize, which counts Nobel laureate Wole Soyinka among its patrons, is given for African writing in English and has become one of the world's most prestigious literary prizes. Today, we'll talk with the winner and two finalists this hour, On Point, New Voices of African Literature. You can join us on air or online. Which African writers have caught your attention? Which of their works are you taking to the beach or book club this summer? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And joining us now from New York is Namwale Serpell. She became the latest winner of the Kane Prize for African Writing on Monday for her story, The Sack. She is 34 years old. I hope she doesn't mind my mentioning that. Originally from Zambia, she's in fact the first Zambian to win the prize. She's currently a professor of English at the University of California, Berkeley. Namwale Serpell, welcome to On Point. Congratulations to you.
Thank you so much, Michelle. Thanks for having me.
What does the significance of the Kane Prize for those who are not aware of it? And was it a big day in your life?
Oh, for me, very much so. It was sort of a deja vu day because a short story I wrote called Muzungu was shortlisted 5 years ago. So it was very interesting to go back at a different stage in my life, a different stage in my career, and a different stage in my writing as well. It means a lot to me that they've honored this particular story because my writing has become a little bit more experimental over time.
We're going to hear more about it, but before we do, I want to bring in from London, Elnathan John. He was a finalist for the Kane Prize for his short story, Flying. He's a writer and lawyer in Nigeria. Elnathan John, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Michelle.
It's great to have you with us as well. And from Johannesburg, South Africa, Masande Tshatanga joins us. He was a finalist for the Kane Prize for his short story, Space. His debut novel, The Reactive, came out last year. And Masande, welcome to you as well. Thank you so much for joining us as well.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So good to have you all with us. And Namwale, I'm going to start with you. Tell us about The Sack. What's it about? And what was your inspiration?
The Sack is about two men who've known each other their whole lives since they were children and who kind of have a relationship that's fraught with both love and affection and hate and resentment because they fell in love with the same woman. The three of them, as young adults, try to create a political movement that failed. And the woman, Naila, who was in a kind of love triangle with these two men, died. The two men are now much older and in a situation which is pretty much characterized by, I would say, debt of monetary and emotional and psychical kinds. And they are living in a house together. One of them is taking care of the other, who is quite sick. And the appearance at their door of a young boy who sells fish starts to unravel all of these kind of knotted histories between them.
You know, you mentioned that the style of it is experimental. It's something that the judges really appreciated. They said it was illuminating, it was luminous, and so many things. Can I persuade you to read just a little bit of the story, perhaps the opening paragraphs?
Sure. There's a sack. A sack? A sack. A sack. Big? Yes. Gray. Like old kwacha. Marks on the outside. No shadows. That's how I know it is moving. Something is moving inside it? The whole sack is moving, down a dirt road with a ditch on the side, with grass and yellow flowers. There are trees above. Is it dark? Yes, but light is coming. It is morning. There's some small birds talking, moving. The sack is dragging on the ground. There's a man pulling it behind him. Who is this man? I can't see his face. He is tallish. His shirt has stains on the back. No socks, businessman shoes. His hands are wet. Does he see you? I don't know. I'm tired now. Close the curtains. Yes, Buona.
And it goes on. And one of the things that's fascinating about it is that you're not always sure who is speaking, you know, what perspective is being seen or heard here. What gave you the inspiration for it? Do you mind telling us?
Sure. There are three inspirations in a way. There's a Japanese horror movie called Audition by Takashi Miike, which revolves around a very creepy sack. I had a dream about a sack when I was about 17 years old, and what was disturbing to me about the dream is that I didn't know if I was inside the sack or outside of the sack, and that kind of pulling of something inside out was very much a part of my attempt to construct the shape of the story, things moving backwards and forwards at the same time, for example. And there's a book of Zambian, I guess, folk stories or superstitions and myths that I picked up in Lusaka maybe 3 or 4 years ago. And it talked about white ants being a particular sign that death is coming. And the description of it was so vivid of if you find white ants have killed your chicken. And so this became a central scene in the novel. The two men become increasingly paranoid for different reasons. And one of them is the appearance of these ants.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the novel. Do I have it right that the sack is meant to be the chapter, perhaps the concluding chapter in a novel?
Yes, I'm at a novel in progress called The Old Drift, for now. Titles do change, which is about Zambia. And so the story about how these two men knew each other as children and became involved in this political movement and were involved in this love triangle is told in the story. So some of the ambiguity about who is speaking, which of the men, Jacob or Joseph, is named Jay in the story, these things sort of get resolved by the preceding, 300 pages or so.
But tell me about the short story form, though. So, I mean, I appreciate that. And I think that when the novel comes out, it will be really interesting for me to kind of see the story in context. But it does work. And clearly the judges felt that it worked on its own as a story standing on its own. I'm interested in your take on the short story form. I've seen an interview with you where you said that actually the short story is a woman's form because women are so busy.
I was sort of taking a leaf out of recent essays. I think there's a book collection called 100 Essays I Don't Have Time to Write, and written by a mother. And I thought, well, this is very interesting to me to think about what is it that constrains our time. And I think what really characterizes the short story is its particular relationship to time. It's something both at the level of writing, you feel you might have the time to write a short story, even if it's intermittent over time. As a reader, you're sort of kept in one place reading one thing. So it allows for a certain kind of concentration of time. But the short story can be so capacious in terms of what it describes in time. It can be about a single moment. It can cover centuries, depending on the writer. So I find this ability to contract and expand in the shorter form really interesting for me as a writer.
It's satisfying. I mean, it's one of the things that it's satisfying for the reader. You feel like you accomplished something. You can read a story and kind of chew on it and think about it and think about, what this means. Would you talk to me a little bit about the whole question of the prize itself? I want to note that you decided to split your prize money, £10,000, about $15,000, with the other finalists. And you said it in an interview, it was a bit of a mutiny. How so?
About a week before the prize was announced, I made this decision by myself. I made a kind of pact to myself. I respected the other stories so much, and meeting the other writers and spending time with Elnathan Masande, FT, and Shagun in London, doing events together, doing readings together, getting to know each other, talking books, talking our favorite, writers and stories. And it just felt very strange that we would go from this very supportive network of five African writers to a kind of American Idol competition or a horse race or battle royale or something. So I made the pact to myself. Basically, I said to myself, in the unlikelihood that I win, because these other stories are so brilliant, I would like to divide it up. So I didn't make that pact with the others. I didn't manage to do that, but I did make it with myself.
There are other artists who feel that way. In fact, we've heard other actors, for example, who have declined to participate in awards programs like the Emmys or the Oscars, which are, quite popular in this country for the very reason that you cited. I mean, did you ever think about not doing it at all, just saying I decline to participate in this because I find that the competitiveness of it is not in alignment with my views of what art should be. Did that thought ever occur?
I think I'm too pragmatic for that. I think my, you know, as one of the judges said to me afterwards, because I said in my acceptance speech, you know, I'm hoping that this will make some way toward changing the structure of prizes like these, which don't actually have to have only one winner. And I, you know, I mentioned to one of the judges after that I had wondered if they would take my act of protest badly because they'd spent all this time making a decision. And then there I was basically mooting it. And she said, well, you know, it's not going to change anything, right? And I said, I did kind of know that because I know literary prizes function in this way. And I also know that there's a reason for it, and or more than one reason for it. It introduces writers like us to the rest of the world. More people read us. It fosters a really lovely momentum, I think, for a lot of people's writing and reading. And so it's not that I think prizes should go away altogether, but that they might be structured slightly differently.
Like how?
And it seemed to
Not that that's not the most important thing we're going to talk about, because obviously we want to hear more about the work. But how would you do it differently?
I would have an award that I received in 2011 called the Rona Jaffe Foundation Award for Women Writers is for 6 women, 2 nonfiction, 2 fiction, and 2 poetry writers. And it's split equally. Oh. And I didn't see why that couldn't be the case this time.
This is On Point. I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook. We are speaking with the winner, and we will soon hear from 2 of the other finalists for the Kane Prize for African Writing. You can join the conversation. Do you seek out literature from around the world? And if so, who are you reading right now? What grabs your attention? Is it an interest in the country or the region or in issues that you hope will be explored in the fiction? Or do you just like a good read? With us still is Nemwale Serpell. She just won the Kane Prize for African Writing for her story, The Sack. She's originally from Zambia. Also with us is L. Nathan John, a finalist for the Kane Prize for his short story, Flying. He's a writer in Nigeria, but we reached him in London. Another finalist, Masandi Nshanga, also joins us. He's from South Africa, and his short story is Space. L. Nathan, I'd like to hear from you now. And I do want to mention that all of the stories will be on the On Point website. You can read all of the stories in their entirety, and I hope you will. So, L. Nathan John, will you tell us a bit about your story, Flying?
My story, Flying, looks at the life within a very short period of a young man who is in secondary school and has a relationship with fellow students in a refuge home and with the proprietress of that home, and how he explores these relationships and discovers things about these individuals one after the other.
Do you mind telling us what your inspiration for it was, or how you got the idea for it?
Well, I actually do fly in my sleep.
Oh.
So, yeah. So I've always wanted to write a story about a person that flies in their sleep.
Oh.
And this was the perfect opportunity to have this story about a young man who actually does fly in his sleep, and how this is connected to human relationships and the form in which we exist in the earth, and how people change, and how not just people change, but whether or not when we pass from one form to the other, living or dead, things actually change.
Will you read us the opening paragraphs?
Yes. I fly when I sleep. Not the ta-ta-ta wing flapping of pigeons and doves, more like the stationary gliding of a plane. My hands are my wings. I run, leap forward, chest out, and will myself to fly. The engine that propels me is my mind, so if, when my eyes are closed, anything bothers or distracts me, I glide for a while, then start to descend sharply and crash. This happens at least 1 out of every 5 times. When it does, I wake up sad and with a headache. But when I am happy, I soar so high I start to feel breathless. Auntie Keturah asks me questions before she states her theories. Do my wings have feathers, or are they wings? Do I usually fly alone? How high do I fly? If my wings have feathers, then I was a bird in my last life. If I fly alone, then I was an eagle. And if I was in company, a vulture. But only if I was bad in the life before that. If I have wings, however, like a butterfly or a bat or the stiff wings of a plane, then maybe I was a bat or pilot. But God forbid bats, she says. God forbid bad creatures caught between lives, neither bird nor mammal. Bad people get trapped between worlds, between bodies, so that they are half this, half that, neither this nor that. You have to be really evil to become a bat. She's afraid of getting a child like that, a bad person from an old life.
Thank you for that. Thank you for that. You have to be really evil to become a bat. I'm going to hold on to that thought. Elnathan, how do you manage your writing life with your lawyer life? Do you still practice law?
I actually killed that life, the lawyer life.
Okay.
I call myself a recovering lawyer. Every so often I'm asked to do an interview that has something to do with law. But yes, I am a full-time writer. I do not practice law in the sense that we say that in Nigeria anymore.
I see. And I'm interested in, we talked just a minute ago with Namwali about the whole competitive nature of it. They didn't have you arm wrestling and so forth as a condition of the prize. but do you have some thoughts about the issue she raised? I mean, she sort of felt in some ways, Namwali, if I hear you properly, I hear you saying you certainly appreciate the attention this draws to your work, but there's something about the idea of pitting artists against each other that doesn't sit well, if I've captured your thoughts properly, right? Have I got that right?
Yes, and I think it felt that way sort of in person, where we'd all be laughing and chatting and then someone would come up and say, I think you should win, and it would just cast a pall over the conversation. So
who would do that?
Many people.
Really?
Everyone.
And like they just single one of you out and say to in front of the others, they say, I think you should win.
Oh, in front of a whole audience of people, they would say, in my opinion, you should win. And also they would offer their good luck, which was always amusing to me, because they'd offer it to each of us. And I would say, who does it actually go to? You know, who does the luck? The luck can only go to one person in this kind of prize.
Well, Nathan, may I ask your opinion about this?
I completely, hello Namwali, but yeah,
hi.
I just thought to say that. But yeah, I completely agree with Namwali, and I think that many people who've been shortlisted for this prize will agree that the atmosphere around which the whole prize is awarded and the emotional roller coaster that leads up to that final very long dinner where the prize is announced can do negative things to a writer. However, I'm one of the supporters of the prize. And while I completely agree with Namwali, I think that the Kane Prize can effect changes to the structure of the prize that will leave the core of its of what it intends to do intact, without, you know, casting this shadow over the prize when shortlisted writers do not go away feeling deflated.
Hmm. Masande, may I ask you this question as well? What do you think about this?
I'm also in agreement with the other two writers. It's something kind of the whole process of competition, and also because it's a prize for African writing, it only makes sense that it would go to more than one person, in theory. So I'm completely in agreement with that.
Tell me more about your thoughts about that. You're saying because it's a prize for African writing, it would make sense that it would go to more than one person. Can you help me understand that? Why? Because Africa is such a big continent, because there are so many different points of view. Tell me why you feel that way. Because one could make that argument about any prize, really, right? I mean, but there's something about the fact that it's for African writing that this calls forth. Tell me why.
I mean, it's incredibly vast as a continent, and also you can tell by the stories that each of them reflect a different sensibility, you know, so there's never just one moment or one perspective from the chase. So for me, it would only make sense if it kind of, in its own way, acknowledged that and something that went just slightly beyond just shortlisting. Hmm.
Can I raise another issue that I'm fascinated by? And you'll have to indulge me here because this may be something you're already over it, but I'm fascinated by it. I'm going to raise it. There's an essay by Ben Okri that appeared in The Guardian in December of 2014, and he decried what he called this tyranny of subject. He said that he felt that let me just read a short bit from it. He said, the first freedom is mental freedom. We have to seize the freedom to be what we can be, to write whatever we want with all the mystery and fire of art. It's our responsibility to illuminate the strange corners of what it is to be human. And literature is the index of our intelligence, our wisdom, our freedom. We must not let anyone define what we write, what we see as worthy of playful or profound investigation in words. And I think the take on it, it's another interesting piece, which we'll also post on our website, but it evoked some rather stringent responses from one. I'll read just one from Sophia Samatar, who said that she doesn't agree. His argument was that a mental tyranny is keeping Black writers from greatness. He feels that there's a kind of an overwhelming pressure, perhaps, to focus on overwhelming subjects like slavery, colonialism, poverty, and war. And he feels that this pressure should not be. And Sophia Samatar is one of those who wrote an answer saying, you know, that she does not agree. She doesn't think that ignores the diversity of Black writing. Anyway, I'm just interested in your take on this. And I heard a couple of you kind of laugh a bit, so I'm guessing that you've already, you know, thought about this or not thought about it as you would. But Namwali, do you mind if I ask you this question? Do you feel kind of a pressure to write about certain things or not?
I've been saying on occasion when people ask me about why I wrote this story, I tell a little anecdote about someone I met in graduate school when I was studying literature, and she was studying contemporary African literature, and she said she had a working theory that every time there was a sack as an image in a story or a novel, that it was a reference to the transatlantic slave trade, that this was because that's how slaves were captured, they were thrown in sacks or something, or this was the idea that people had. And so when I wrote the story, that was in my mind as something I was resisting. I didn't want to have an image that could only be read one way. That it would maybe invoke slavery didn't bother me, but that it would only be read in one way bothered me, which is to say that I do think that as writers from Africa, we feel a kind of pressure to write about certain issues, but I don't think that pressure ends up constraining the art. I think it can only make it better that we have so much to draw from historically, culturally, as persons. I'm always quoting this line or paraphrasing this line from Toni Morrison about being a Black woman, which is that doesn't constrain me. That has only added to my experience. So I think to say that we shouldn't write about certain topics is to ignore how much potential and richness is in those topics, and also that those are real parts of our lives as Africans when we're home and when we talk to people at home, that these are real issues. So I don't know. I think what he says is right. I think people should write about whatever they want and they should aspire to write about great things. But I don't think that writing about poverty or slavery or, you know, the HIV/AIDS crisis is constraining at all.
Do you feel pressure, though, that you feel that you must, if you wanted to write about, you know, just a, I don't know, just, how can I one say just, a, you know, a love story, like two students, you know, at Oxford who meet, you know, on a park bench, you know, could you do that?
I personally don't feel those constraints. Two students at Berkeley who
meet on a park bench.
Right, right. No, I mean, I don't know if El Nathan and Masande feel this way, but I don't feel constrained. I've written stories set in the States. I've written science fiction satire about a sex robot. I've written a satire of Faces and the Book of Job called The Book of Faces. I've written all sorts of different things. So I personally don't feel constrained to write only about dark, you know, the darkest dark of Africa or whatever it might be. I think in some ways the response against Ben Okri has been from writers who feel like, yes, we know, of course we know that we should write about whatever we want to write about. And we are, and we have been.
Elnathan, what do you think?
Yes, for me, there are certain words that make me uncomfortable when I first hear them. Words like greatness or authenticity, I'm immediately suspect. When a person uses them, they're almost always either being pretentious or will go overboard. And for me, the very premise, and I'm not going to be as nice as Namwali, the very presence, the very premise of that article was problematic. It was premised upon the fact that the writer of that article knew what African writing was and had read African writing vastly. And two, that all African writing was African writing in English. And that it had this predominant theme. I can, for example, talk about 100 novels published in the last year in Hausa in Nigeria, just in northern Nigeria, in one city, which is more than all of the English novels that are published internationally from Africa, just in that one language. And so, of course, I keep saying, what African writing is he talking about? So you see, the very premise of the whole argument for me is demolished, because you are talking based on 5, 10, 20 books, perhaps, published in the English language from the continent. And so for me, this whole issue of mental slavery, I think, is the concept is itself problematic. Also, I think that it's again easy. I live on the continent. I live in Nigeria, in Abuja. And as it is, in the past 40 days, almost 500 people have died from bombs. I'm not interested in the politics of what or what not to write. It is a valid subject for me. I also live in a place where there's a lot of love and laughter. And I write about love and laughter. I'm in a place where there's a lot of superstition. I write about that. My Cane Prize story was about flying, a young man that flies in his sleep. And so I actually do not even agree that writers are being constrained. Maybe a few writers who are in the English writing scene, in this very little English writing scene, international English writing scene from Africa. And that's how many writers. I can count them, you know, I can literally count all of these writers.
But perhaps...
But there's a large body of writing in Swahili, in English. In South Africa, there are writers who have been writing for 20, 30 years who've never been published internationally.
Important. Masende, thoughts about this?
Well, to speak personally, I don't feel any pressure to attach myself to any particular themes outside of what kind of interests and captivates me. I think, personally, with my own development, I actually started off writing about things that weren't attached to my environment, actually, with work that was a lot more experimental and just placed, like, anywhere. And I actually moved from that to work that was more rooted in my society, because I found that that was the work that, for me personally, in the end, felt like a living thing that was vital and interacted with the community. And that's kind of what I aspire to. I wouldn't necessarily think it's a restraint in that the perspective one can have looking at African writing from the West and from within Africa is something that also kind of can reveal quite strong discrepancies. Mm-hmm. For example, in South Africa, with a lot of artists, there's the impulse to kind of recast or recontextualize historical narratives. And that goes as far as kind of looking back to the past and
Masadi, I'm going to ask you to hold that thought. We're going to hear more about you. We will hear more from you about this after we take a short break. I'm Michelle Martin in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we hope you'll stay with us.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
The This is On Point. I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking with the winner and two of the finalists for the Cain Prize for African Writing. You can join the conversation and tell us about your summer fiction picks. What are you looking for in a summer read? With us now are Namwale Serpell. She won the Cain Prize for African Writing on Monday for her story, The Sack. She is originally from Zambia. Notice how I dropped my voice there so as not to be painful. Namwale has critiqued this whole idea of, you know, artists, you know, winning things and competing against each other. So I was saying that very softly. And also with us is L. Nathan John, a finalist for the Cain Prize for his short story, Flying. He is a writer in Nigeria, but we caught up with him in London. Another finalist, Masande Tshanga, also joins us. He's from South Africa. His short story is Space, and he's with us from Johannesburg. Masande, before the break, and I'm going to ask you to read your story in just a moment, or read the beginning of your story in just a moment. And I want to remind our listeners that you can read the entirety of these stories in their entirety, and all of the stories, all of the finalists on our website. I was asking you about this whole question of whether you feel, you know, pressure to focus on certain subjects, and you were saying that you don't. I was wondering whether, in fact, Ben Okri's essay was actually more of a critique of the reading public. I mean, it seems like the sort of the premise of it is that, just in Sophia Samatar's essay responding to his essay, which also appeared in The Guardian and can also be found on theguardian.com and on our website, she says that, you know, for Okri, mental tyranny is defined by repetition and prescription. The problem with Black fiction is the repetition of overwhelming subjects, which is prescribed by the demands of a white reading public. So I wondered, in some way, was it a critique of the reading public for sort of wanting to only think about certain things from certain places? And I just wondered if you had ever felt that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's very difficult to speak for the reading public, but the critique definitely would make more sense as something directed at that, or perhaps even African publishing, as opposed to African writers.
Well, I'll just read a comment that we have from a listener on Facebook. Anne McDonald says that we must explore more African literature. It seems to be blossoming at this time, perhaps because of or as a result of the explosive social and geopolitical upheavals on the African continent that have been shaping it during the last three decades. Recently, I read and was riveted by Uwem Akpan's Say You're One of Them, which consisted of five long stories, maybe even could be called short novels, and a short story, My Parents' Bedroom, for which Akpan shared the 2007 Cain Prize. Astounding stuff, she says. And I'm also reminded, you know, Namwale, of the when I interviewed, you know, Father Akpan. He's also a Catholic priest. And he said, I asked him what his inspiration for his stories was. And he said, well, I just have to write about the things that are making me crazy.
Yes.
What do you think that, Namwale?
That haunt us.
Yeah. Do you think that's so do you see that there's an explosion happening, or is it just something that we're just kind of getting around to on our side of the world here?
It's a little bit of the latter, I think. I mean, I think African writing. I mean, if you just think about African storytelling, it's been around forever and in local languages. But it was necessary for those stories to be in English for the, you know, the Western world or the Commonwealth post-colonial world to be able to understand them. But the writer Amos Tutuola, who wrote the Palm Wine Drinkyard, and was published in England by T.S. Eliot, you know, he was in a sense a kind of modernist. And so this kind of experimental writing, this exciting new writing, I don't think can be linked directly to specific historical upheavals. I think there's always been incredible writing from African writers. And I think that the West is taking note and the rest of the world is taking note is wonderful, but it's not anything new for us.
It's interesting, though, you know, you live outside of the continent. You go home. I take it you go home at least once a year.
Yeah.
But you spend most of your time, your working sort of life, living in the U.S. and working in the U.S. and teaching in the U.S. How do you think that affects your work?
As a writer? Or as
yes, a writer. No, as a writer.
I think, you know, there was a point when I was finishing up my graduate studies when I went on the academic job market, and this was before the recession, so it was before the academic jobs kind of vanished from face of the planet. So I was very lucky to get a job that year. But at that point, there was a kind of turning point for me. And it was either I get a job here, and I got one job, and that's all I needed, or I move home and I write. So to me, the options seemed quite equal. And I can't really say how being in the States has affected my writing about Zambia. But I can say that it has affected my writing about America, because I've written about America, because I've been here. People have asked me, you know, is your writing more inspired by your American side or your Zambian side? And I say, you know, the honest answer is both, and a whole lot of other countries as well, like the Japanese horror movie I mentioned, or Roberto Bolaño, who is an inspiration for this story as well, or Ian McEwan, whose Atonement was an inspiration for my first short story that was shortlisted in 2010. So to me, I have a very, in Zambia we call it movious, which means kind of nomadic. I have a very movious mind, and so the question of geography doesn't seem to, I don't know, it doesn't make complete sense to me.
It's interesting that people who, you seem to sort of move with ease across all of these places, and that is the story of many of the writers that whom we speak with, that they live quite comfortably. They're here, they're there, they're in Europe, they're in the U.S., back to Africa, back and forth. You know, it used to be that if you moved around a lot, you were either comfortable everywhere or comfortable nowhere. What about you, Nomwali? What do you think?
I think it's a bit of both. I mean, I don't think that there's any place that is quite my home. But when the word falls out of my mouth on occasion in reference to myself, it's usually about Zambia. Mm.
Let's hear from Masande. Masande, we'd love to hear about your story, Space. Will you read a little bit of it, just the opening paragraphs, if you would?
Okay. I guess you won't believe him either, but this is what CK tells us this morning. He says there's a gray man living in the shed behind Matano's Bazaar shop on Mia Street. A man who isn't a man, once sent down to Earth from a distant place. Where we are is the local, the name our parents give to the local primary school they pack us off to each morning here in Bisho. And the way CK is saying this, it's the last day of school when the four of us, that's him, Tando, Tumela, and me, we're slouching at the back of our Afrikaans classroom again, our bodies turning to slushed ice from the promise of having failed yet another take-home test in Bidal. CK keeps talking. He says how this man, behind Matano's barber shop, he isn't the same as any other man he's ever seen before. CK leans forward and tells us that this guy, whatever he is just something we have to set our own eyes on. I nod, but all this time CK's whispering. All this time he's writing us notes about this gray man. What I'm doing is watching Mrs. Siviwe, our teacher, watching how she's sitting at the front end of our classroom with her head down, and watching how she's scratching red lines in each exercise book that passes under her pen.
This story is set in South African history in 1992. So this is after Mandela's release from prison, right? But before the all race elections, and before the kind of all race inclusive kind of government. Why did you choose that time period?
Because I'd spent some of my childhood in Bisho, which then was the capital of the Ciskei homeland, and it had always struck me as a very kind of strange place, one surrounded by kind of very fraught political unrest, but at the same time very pristine and suburban in large sections of it. And growing up and experiencing that as a child or early adolescence was always kind of a strange sensation that I hoped I could capture one day in fiction.
I was intrigued by and kind of appreciated the details, and it made me think like what it would be like to be, you know, an African child, a Black African child, sitting in the Afrikaans classroom and knowing that this is something that you had to master to you know, if you wanted to sort of move into certain, you know, professions and how, you know, how that would feel. And the story goes on to sort of talk about the students' anxiety about their kind of academic performance. I was really, you know, appreciating that side of it. Tell us a little bit more about the story and just what were you thinking about as you wrote it?
Well, primarily, I really wanted to capture the place. With my work, I'd reached a point where I felt I wasn't evoking enough of where I was from in the work, and it's something that I really wanted to work on. And once I got started, once I started kind of envisioning the characters, it's a story that kind of took on its own logic. You know, I kind of just followed the characters from one scene to the next and realized that by the end, it was also kind of a story about drawing the parallel between personal narratives and historical narratives. The end of adolescence, or rather the end of childhood, contrasted with the end of apartheid in the story.
Yes, and you know, and also, I also wanted to ask about your debut novel, The Reactive, which follows an HIV-positive young man in Cape Town in the early 2000s. You might tell us a little bit about that story as well, or about that novel as well.
The Reactive is where actually everything that I was trying in my story gets a treatment that's actually, I would say, more fully realized. It's a story about a young man in Cape Town, as you said, in the early 2000s, who sells antiretroviral drugs with his two friends, Rowan and Cecilia. The original inspiration for the book is that I wanted to write a very kind of modern or contemporary novel about Cape Town, in the sense that Cape Town could be any other world city, and just to explore the lives of young people from what it must have been like, I suppose, 10 years ago, and also some of the things that have carried over to the present day.
Hmm. I want to take a call from Windham, Connecticut. Mary is calling us now. Mary, how are you? Thank you for calling.
Yes, just fine. Thank you very much for taking my call. And I want to thank you very much for having this program, and I want to congratulate all the writers. I just don't have words to tell you how grateful I am for your art. So thank you very much for that. But, Michelle, I wanted to answer your question about African writers that we are reading.
Yes, I want to hear. Yes.
Yes. One that I've read, actually, he's a colleague of mine. He's a professor of English at Eastern Connecticut State University. His name is Raouf Mama, and his latest book is called Fortune's Favored Child, and it's a memoir. And it begins, of course, with his life in Benin, which is where he's from, and it's a narrative of his early life there, and I think the beginning of his life in the United States. But he's a storyteller. I know that there was an allusion, I think it was by the winner of the prize. She mentioned storytelling in the African oral tradition, and this professor is a master storyteller. So I just wanted to point him out to all of you and to the listening audience, because he's also an African writer who deserves a lot of attention. He's a wonderful writer. And again, the book is Fortune's Favored Child. It was published last year.
All right. Well, thank you, Mary. Thank you so much for calling us. Thanks for that recommendation. I'm always so fascinated by how people are introduced to writers who are kind of outside of their own circle. Like, is it word of mouth? Is it a book club? Is it, you know, a friend passes it to you and just says, look, I think you'll just kind of love this. Namali, do those kinds of things interest you too? Do you want to know how people find your work, or is it enough that they do?
Well, I was going to say, I'm not sure what's outside of one circle looks like in the age of the internet 3.0 or whatever it is at this point. The circles are overlapping and multiplying like bubbles. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for me,
that's a very good point. I'm just wondering, do you take a class, especially once you leave school, like once you've left college and you're no longer required to read things and it's your choice, like how do people decide what they want to explore and discover.
I do think that's one of the reasons prizes like this are important. As L. Nathan said, at the core of the Kane Prize is a desire to spread the news, is just to spread the word about African writing. And that itself is a wonderful way for people to access. The Kane Prize website has, I think, a list of all of the shortlisted writers since 2000. And that's 15 years worth of five people each time. And I think it actually has some of the PDFs of the stories themselves. And that's just the short stories. But you can follow those names because many of the shortlisted writers for the Kane Prize then go on to publish novels. No Violet Bulawayo's book, the first chapter of it was a Kane Prize winning short story. Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie was nominated for the Kane Prize. Binyavanga Wainana was nominated for the Kane Prize. So prizes like this do that work.
What are you working on now? Nawali, what are you working on yet?
Oh,
yes. Yes. What are you working on now?
This novel. I'm working on this novel, The Old Drift. I'm also working on a nonfiction essay about a very eccentric figure from Zambian history who created a Zambian space program in the 60s. And he's often perceived as a kind of eccentric, but I've been doing research and finding out the ways in which he was actually a very politically intense freedom fighter as well.
Oh, exciting. Well, we will look forward to that. Namwale Serpell is winner of the Kane Prize for African Writing this year. Thank you all so much for joining us, and congratulations to you once again.
Thank you, Michelle.
And L. Nathan John and Masandi Tushanga were with us. They were also finalists for the Kane Prize. They were with us as well. Thank you so much for taking time away from your work and your exhausting schedules and recent round of activities to join us for this conversation. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
And you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up Monday, bootcamp-style rehabilitation centers in China to treat internet addiction. I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.